All right, so I think we left off on hatchling or hatching plasticity,
which I think is right around this area. So what we're going to do is basically finish up talking about predator-induced plasticity as well as competitor-induced plasticity, and then we're going to have the discussion with whatever time is left. We'll see how much we got. So we're shifting to the effects of basically predators on the larvae. So first off, aquatic predators are going to be very diverse in form as well as abundance. So if we look at these predators, for example, we have things like water bugs. Once again, they have this basically this little mouth part here. It kind of resembles a straw. And the way they consume a tadpole is they actually pierce the skin with their with that little straw and then insert digestive enzymes and basically suck the juice out of the tadpole. So they kind of leave behind this kind of empty sack of tadpole. On the other hand, if you look at something like a larval dragonfly, as you see here, these guys basically chew up the whole tadpole. They consume the whole thing. But they're very voracious, especially this is like either an anax or an echinid dragonfly, and they really will chow down on tadpoles. That's when they cage it. They call it non-lethal. So different terminology. So if you have a predator inside a cage, it's considered non-lethal to the tadpoles that are outside the cage. But obviously, the prey that you feed the predator inside the cage get nailed by that predator. So we also have things like a mud minnow, which is Umbra. And mud minnows are also very effective predators. We'll talk about those guys in the next part of this slide here. And then this is a larval salamander. So we've heard about many bistamatids, for example, eating these tadpoles. So these guys also vary in how much risk they pose to the different prey species. So I put up this table here to kind of just go through not only the different predators, but also the different prey species that we're talking about. So if we start off here with toads, you know, these toads, and we've talked about it, usually are pretty distasteful to things like vertebrates. So if you look at three things, capture efficiency is basically the number of strikes that a predator will make and the number of successful attempts of those strikes is going to turn into capture efficiency. Palatability is the number of successful captures, the number of prey eaten given the number of successful captures. So that basically tells you, you know, how many times is a prey getting released after the predator actually captures it. Then handling time is a total amount of time it takes it to consume the tadpole from the time it grabs it to the time it's completely digested or completely taken in. So if you look at toads, get Umbra. Once again, this is the mud minnow, dragonfly, newt, red spotted newt, and a beetle larvae. So you look at capture efficiency. Fish, dragonflies, 100%. Toads are very easy for them to capture. But if you look at palatability, very, very low. The fish actually spit these guys out. You know, because they have those toxins in their skin, you know, most fish will just kind of grab them, spit them out, or even not attack them whatsoever. You know, once they learn that it is a toad in the environment, they'll actually just avoid them. They won't even eat them. But if you look at, let's see, this anax, you know, if it did eat it, there was only one individual that ate a toad. It goes down pretty quick, about 2 minutes. If we look at newts, though, you know, capture efficiency, they're doing it about 60% of the time. They'll capture the toad, they attack it. Kind of a little higher palatability, they will spit them out. But if you look at handling time, it goes down about 45 seconds. They do that because when they open their mouth, basically that tadpole just gets sucked right in. And basically all it's hanging out is the tail. So that's why it kind of takes them a little bit of time to consume it. Dytiscus, on the other hand, you know, pretty poor capture efficiency, about 50-50 chance of catching it. High palatability. So this is interesting because, you know, toads have a toxin in their skin, but dytiscids, once again, attack in a different way than we see with Umbra and anax. They have something very similar to the Belostoma, or the water bug up there. They also use a mouth part, and they basically inject enzymes once again and then suck the fluids out. So they get right past the skin. They don't even worry about the skin. All they're targeting is the inside tissues. So they're not kind of deterred by that distasteful toxin in the skin. Handling time, though, tends to be very long because they're digesting it basically from the inside. It takes them a while. They just sit there and they suck on the tadpole over time and they take it in. Kind of interesting. Then we have wood frogs, leopard frogs, very similar patterns that we see here. You know, for the most part, most predators, pretty easy to capture these guys. Palatability tends to be pretty high, except for leopard frogs with umbra. Leopard frogs also, we've talked about this a little bit, have some toxins in their skin. They're kind of distasteful to most fish for predators. So they will spit them out a little bit. But in general, handling times vary from about 30 seconds to about 2 minutes, except for your sucking predators, we'll call them. The ditticids, the water bugs usually take longer, about half hour to consume a tadpole. Okay, so what I'm trying to show you here is that, you know, risk varies depending on the prey species, the predator species, and that's driven by things like whether or not there's distasteful chemicals in the skin, and also how the predator actually feeds. If it's just a predator that engulfs prey, chews prey, or injects prey, those differences will lead to differences in risk. Make sense? All right, so here's a picture basically showing you that predators are variable in space as well as time. So this is data from the George Reserve in Michigan by, you know, many of the same people that you guys have already read, Earl Werner, Rick Relier, Dave Skelly have all done work on this reserve. But this graph is showing you data from 1996 on the left, 1997 on the right. And these are basically different types of ponds. You either have open canopy ponds here, closed canopy ponds, and you have that within both years, and then four different ponds within that category. And all I'm really trying to show you here is if you look at things like closed canopy ponds, predator diversity is pretty low, right? So they're dominated by things like salamanders. You don't see a high diversity of predators. You know, same here in the second year, we do have the addition of some beetle larvae, so ditticid larvae. And that's generally what you're going to find in a closed canopy pond, that salamanders come in and breed, but you also have basically hydrophyllids and occasionally ditticids will be there. Sometimes you'll see liabluids, but those predators tend to be pretty rare in those habitats. Contrast that with an open canopy pond where you see much more diversity. You see all these three groups. So liabluids are another type of dragonfly. Echinids are the dragonflies that I told you about. Hydrophyllids are a beetle larvae, very similar to a ditticid larvae. Okay, but you find much more diversity in those open canopy ponds, but you also find variation within these ponds. So some ponds have, you know, twice the diversity or twice the abundance of predators than another pond. So for example, if you look at this closed canopy pond, there's about 15 salamanders per meter squared. Here you have zero. So their spatial as well as temporal variation in predation risk. So that's really setting up this idea of plasticity that I talked about in the previous lecture. We need environmental heterogeneity to really drive the evolution of plasticity. Okay, so now we need to figure out what cues are prey using to detect or to detect these predators. So here's a ditticid beetle larvae. In case you're interested, you can see what it's doing right here. It basically has these two pinchers, and it just kind of clamps them down on the tadpole and then consumes it. But anyway, how do you think these larvae are detecting the presence of a predator? That's my question to you. What's that? What's that? Scent. Scent. So, yes, it could be scent. So they could smell a predator in the water. How else could they detect a predator in the water? Sight, motion, anything else?
Vibration,
so it's mechanical stimulation. So all those things can play a point of role. So they could see the predator, you know, the predator could actually touch them. You know, if you're kind of sitting there in the habitat, a predator sneaks up on you, touches you, then you know a predator is around. Chemical cues or scent cues can be used to detect the predator. So for these aquatic larvae, which one of these cues do you think is the most important for these guys to be able to detect a predator in the environment? Why do you say that?
Dissolving water a lot easier.
Okay. Okay, so diffusion. Diffusion is basically really easy in an aquatic environment, right? Well, there's some other reasons for chemical cues being really important.
Pick up on easier than point visual cues. Sometimes,
like,
if the water is murky, you're not going to see visual cues as much.
Like that?
Or not
360-degree view of yourself either. Right. Yeah, so you may not, if you rely on a visual cue, you may not always see the predator. So for example, if you look at these two tanks, these are cattle watering tanks that have been set up to basically mimic what a pond looks like. And here's two different basic ways that basically the water column can look. So it could be really cloudy, or it could be really clear. Now if you're a larvae in this environment, okay, maybe you could use sight, you know, potentially. You know, you still have that problem that if it's behind you, the predator's behind you, you may not escape. But in here, if you rely on visual cues or even tactile cues, you're going to get nailed by that predator if it's just kind of running around the environment searching for you. So that would basically mean that chemical cues would be more important. And indeed, when we look at some of the research, you know, chemical cues have been the main focus for understanding predator-induced plasticity in these guys. And just another thing to point out here, this is going to be relevant to Dr. Rauke's talk when he comes, I guess the beginning of April. This tank here actually received the application of malathion, an insecticide, whereas this one received no insecticide. So he's going to come in and talk about things like trophic cascades. And what happens if you hit this tank with a pesticide, it knocks out certain taxa, and he'll talk about the taxa. I don't want to give everything away. But basically, this is the contrast that he's talking about. You have a very cloudy tank, which can influence things like paraffin levels, because it's very cloudy, light doesn't penetrate as well. But in this tank here, light penetrates well, basically the community is still intact. So something to think about when he comes in and what he's actually going to talk about. Gives you a, kind of a picture of what the communities look like and how they're altered by pesticides. Okay, so these chemical cues that we're talking about. Just a couple things to mention here, and we're going to talk in more detail about this later, but the chemical cues are basically composed of two different things, which are alarm cues, which are released by damaged or consumed prey. Okay, and there's also things called pheromones, which are released by the predators. Okay, like I said, we're going to talk a lot about this a little later, but basically, you can have these two things separated in one of the experiments I'll talk about. So you have basically the smell of a predator and then also the smell of the prey. And you have to think about, you know, how can you use these two things to figure out what's going to eat you. Is that one of the things I left off? All right. Any questions about that? Okay. Okay, so just want to briefly go over how we design these experiments. So first off, if we just put a predator and prey together, mortality rates are going to be really, really high. So by caging predators, what we can do is make use of these chemical cues, because what they do is they diffuse through the water, like Nathan was saying, and the prey can pick up on those cues. So what we typically do is have this little cage here, and we'll put an anax in there or a water bug, feed that predator some prey, and then the chemical cues will basically diffuse through that through the water, because this cage is composed of basically window screen on both ends. So the cues can diffuse through the water. Let's see what else. And we basically use a variety of experimental units. We use lab experiments, but we also use mesocosms, either these small kiddie wading pools, which hold about 100 liters of water, or these giant cattle watering tanks that hold about 1,000 liters of water. So we really try and mix it up. We also occasionally will use some natural pond experiments. So we'll actually put pens in pens inside a natural pond to see, you know, how does experimental venue affect these responses to predators. And then basically over time, what we do is we measure these larvae for morphology, which we'll talk about, and we also observe their behavior to see how they're responding to the predator environments. Okay, so first off, let's look at behavioral responses. You know, three common things you'll do in the presence of a predator include reducing your activity level is a big thing. So basically, avoid being seen is a good idea. So you increase your use of refuges, and you also avoid the presence of a predator. So just some data here. We have percent active, as well as percent near the predator on the right. So several different treatments. We have a no predator treatment. Once again, mud minnow or a dragonfly larvae. Two prey species, bullfrogs and green frogs. And generally what you see, if you look at bullfrogs, for example, reducing activity with a mud minnow, they reduce even further with an anax. So they're just becoming less active. They're basically foraging less in the water column if they detect that predator in the water. And we see a very similar response with green frogs. So they reduce activity with umbra even further with anax. Okay? They also spatially avoid the predator. So what you can look at is basically if you divide a tub in half, you look at the number of tadpoles that are close to the predator cage, number of tadpoles that are away from the predator cage. And in general, what we see, both species, although to certain degrees, avoid the predator. So if you have a mud minnow or an anax present, they'll go on the other side of the tub, away from the predator. Okay, it makes sense. So they can actually, which is interesting though, because they can actually locate the predator. You have a small tub, and they still know where the predator is. You would think there would be kind of a, basically a saturation of the water in that small experimental unit. But there's a slight gradient they can pick up on and basically know to go to the other side of the tub that the predator's on. So that's pretty cool that they can pick up on that difference. Okay, just some more data looking at, once again, percent activity and the number of tadpoles are on the same side as the predator in the tub. So this is kind of a messy graph. But just to break it down, we have basically five different treatments here. No predator, mud minnow, dragonfly, and salamanders, or Dytiscid or Bellostoma, which is the water bug or the beetle larvae. And what I want to do here is basically just show you, first off, that each one of these species varies in how active they are. So this is all activity, absence of a predator. So if you look at toads, in general, they're much more active than any of the other species. And that's probably because they tend to be pretty distasteful with those predators because of their skin. If we look at things like green frogs, generally the lowest activity of all these tadpoles. And then bush frogs and tree frogs kind of have this moderate activity. Okay, so there's variation in kind of basal activity level. If we look at toads, for example, just kind of focus on those guys, we see they have differing responses to these different predators. So if you have a mud minnow in there, they respond by reducing activity by about 10%. But if you throw something like an anax in there, they reduce it to about 15% active. Okay, so there's variation in the effect that predators have on prey. Now, if you look at the same thing with wood frogs, they respond very strongly to fish, mud minnows, and they still respond to anax and the salamanders as well as the water bugs, but not to as great a degree as they respond to mud minnows. Okay, so there's going to be variation there. Any questions about that? So that's behavior, turn to morphology, and within the past, I'd say 20 years or so, we've discovered that nerns and salamanders can respond to the presence of a predator, and they change a variety of traits. So if you look at this video, which I'm going to play right now, I forgot I was going to do that. So this video that I'm going to play is from Rick Relia's research, and it's going to be on gray tree frogs.
This tadpole doesn't waste energy growing protective bulk when the pond is safe. Instead, it diverts all its energies to becoming a North American tree frog. private pond. Dragonflies themselves are harmless to tadpoles, but the eggs they lay under the water's surface will hatch into something deadly.
It's like Jaws.
Dragonfly nymphs are more than a match for a poorly streamlined tadpole with a body designed for eating. The tadpole's chances of escape slim. But only the first tadpoles are easy. Things in this pond are about to change. This tadpole's watch is over, but its death will help its siblings to survive. The mangled prey oozes body fluids containing special alarm chemicals. These diffuse through the water to its relatives, activating genes that trigger an extraordinary transformation. Over the next few days, the tadpoles pack on weight and grow large red tails. These large red-tailed tadpoles are the same species as the thinner brown-tailed variety, but the red-tails are the anti-predator version. The larger tail gives them greater acceleration, making them very hard to catch. Their color is more of a mystery. Red may be a warning to predators. But these tadpoles are too fast for them. Red-tailed tadpoles take longer to become frogs, but it's better to arrive late than never. Sophisticated defenses like this evolved from millions of years of conflict between predators and prey.
I love showing that thing. My favorite part is where the tadpole just kind of oozes stuff. It's great. Okay, so, you know, this is the species they were talking about, so the gray tree frog. So some common responses include things like the deeper tail as well as a shorter tail. So if you see here, it's not as clear in this picture as it is over here with the wood frogs. So you can see how deep the tail is compared to this guy. They also form generally small bodies. And in some species, you'll see greater tail pigmentation that tends to occur with many of the hylids. Things like spring peepers will get a little darker tail. Gray tree frogs obviously get darker tails. But any questions about those responses? So why would, you know, they covered this a little bit in that little video. What are the benefits of a deeper tail? What can they do? Swimming faster. Okay. What other things could it do? Okay. Yeah, so if a predator sees red, it may be something that's distasteful. Okay. Right? So it could just see him as, you know, way too big of a target to attack. What else could that be? So if you have a large tail, a really small body, what could that do in terms of the predator? Why not? Okay, so if it can tell the difference between a big body and a small body, it'd say, okay, this isn't as profitable for me to eat, so I may avoid it. Okay. What else could this bright red tail do? Flash color. So we kind of talked about that, right? So it says I'm distasteful, maybe. Right. Yeah. So it can make them faster. Anything else? I'm trying to get you there, but. What's that? Sorry.
Go ahead.
Camouflage?
Other chances that maybe the predator goes tails or...
Right, exactly. So what can happen, one idea is that the predator may target that bright red tail. But it could be a flash color too. So it would depend. So it may work for the hylids, for example, that do form this bright red tail, but some of the other species, like the wood frogs, for example, they don't get a bright red tail. Sometimes it will turn a little darker, but it's not as, you know, colorful as some of the other species. So, you know, while it may work here, it may not be a general advantage to having that tail. Or you could have, you know, what someone said earlier, you know, just having this big tail could deflect the target to the predator's actions towards the tail by just being bigger. And the point is that the tail is expendable. So if the tail rips, it really doesn't matter. And actually, if you look at a tree frog, if you pick up those guys and you kind of lift up on the tail, you'll completely destroy the tail. So it breaks off, not the whole tail, but the tail fin breaks very easily. So if a predator does attack it, the tadpole gets away 90% of the time, over 100% of the time, because it, you know, this is basically an expendable area. It's better to lose a tail, which you really don't need as an adult, obviously. Rather lose that tail than to have the predator attack your body. Any questions about that? Okay, so this is some data from, once again, a pen experiment that was done in a natural pond using different populations of wood frogs. So once again, we have on the x-axis here either no predator or a caged anax, okay, dragonfly. And we're looking at tail depth on the left, body length on the right. And immediately what you see are some of the responses of these different populations. You know, all four populations tend to increase tail depth in the presence of a dragonfly, okay? Body length tends to decrease, okay? But you can see that there's some variation here, which is driven by these different populations. So the populations differed in the degree of plasticity. So if you think about local adaptation, well, each one of these populations was from a different habitat that could have had different levels of predation risk in the past that put selective pressures on them to respond to dragonflies in a certain way. So you can get that local adaptation. For example, one of these species, or one of these populations, could have experienced, you know, several generations of very low predation pressure, so it could respond less to the predator. You know, various combinations of that. Okay. Here's some data looking at different families within a population. So once again, here's tail depth, no predator, caged predator, and you see here that these families differ in the expression of plasticity. So vary in basically the slope of this line. See, this line right here is very flat, very little plasticity. You know, some of these are very strong. So that suggests the important genetic variation for plasticity. So if you have that variation, you can have evolution of these reaction norms, okay? Okay, I just want to talk about the benefits of these responses very quickly. So this is going to be some data from out west using the Pacific tree frog. And what they did is they raised these larvae with three cage predators, and that included a cage bluegill, a cage beetle, and here's your control in the middle. Now they're doing something different here with bluegill than they are with, you know, your typical insect predators. They're responding to these predators by decreasing tail depth as well as decreasing body depth. So basically they're going the opposite direction of the responses we've been talking about. So what they did was then, after they figured out what these tadpoles are doing behaviorally as well as morphologically, they exposed them to lethal predators to see which phenotypes survive best, or basically longest, with these predators. So here's the data for that. So here you see proportion of tadpoles remaining, and your three treatments are right here. So if you're raised with... we'll start down here at the bottom. This is with a lethal bluegill. If you're raised with bluegill and you're put in with that lethal bluegill, you survive much longer than the other two treatments. If we look at the top graph, this is if you're raised with a, or with, put in with a lethal beetle predator. Now, if you're
rays with beetles, you survive a little better than you do with a control, but both of those survive better than the bluegill phenotype. So that suggests there's phenotypic trade-offs. So if you're rays with beetle predators, you do well with beetle predators, but you get nailed by bluegill predators, and then vice versa. Okay. They were actually, in this, I didn't show you the data, but they're actually the same size in mass. So there weren't any differences overall. What they think is that they actually have a different impression of the, they actually had longer tails as well. So they think that gave them greater, not just burst speed, but kind of sustained speed. So I think that helped them get away more so than some of the other phenotypes did. So, you think if you have a deeper tail, that gives you better kind of acceleration, so rapid start, but doesn't help long-term swim. So I think the longer tail actually improves long-term swimming, so that benefit them against the bluegill, which actually, once they find you, they keep chasing you until they get you. It's a little different than like an anax, a dragonfly, which attacks once, you get away. Anax doesn't keep following you. It kind of stops and waits for prey to go by again, because it's a sit-and-wait predator. Any other questions? Okay, you may be thinking about, well, okay, I showed you all these different responses to predators. Well, how would these guys respond to combined predators when you have multiple predators in the same habitat? So here are some ideas. So if you have some phenotypic response, say it's tail depth, and you have two predators that when alone are inducing a slight increase, or sorry, predator A induces a slight increase, but predator B induces a fairly strong response. How should you respond if both predators are combined? What are some of your ideas?
Somewhere in the middle.
So you're saying right about here, right? So basically what are you doing? You're kind of averaging the risk of those two predators, saying, okay, well, this one, I'm going to respond so much to this guy, so much to this guy. Let's just balance it out. Okay, which one? So say that again. Sorry.
So respond to predator B more.
Respond to B more? So you're saying you're going to form a phenotype somewhere up here? Okay.
Just to weigh him out. Because, for instance, say predator A was a bug, predator B was a bluegill, if you respond to the bluegill by getting faster, then odds are you're more likely going to be able to, at least some of the time, be able to avoid predator A as well.
Okay. So why would you, in that case, form a higher phenotype? Or a greater phenotype?
Just so you could outdo B.
You can have two things, right? So you could, I have this laid out somewhere. Where are those dots coming in? All right, so here we go. We got the red dot there. So this is what someone said first off, right? You're basically balancing those two predators. You're saying, I'm gonna produce an intermediate phenotype. Now this one brings me up so far. This one takes me all the way up. Well, maybe I should just kind of average the two risks. Does this make much sense to you guys? Why doesn't it make sense, Jose?
If you average, you're still going to be, a prey.
Okay, right.
You don't necessarily will survive at all.
Right, right. Right, so both these predators are present, but if you produce this phenotype, this intermediate phenotype, you're not very well defended against this guy. You are well defended against this guy, so let's say predation's reduced here. But your phenotype, if this is optimal phenotype, you're not well defended in that case.
So why wouldn't you just say it, baby?
So you could do that. you could stay right at B. So this is saying, well, A's here, I'm already pretty well defended if I just respond to B. I don't have to worry about A anymore. Okay? So in this case, you're just responding essentially to the most risky predator if B is more risky than A. Yeah, for example. You could also have something like this, where you combine the two responses. So you basically say, this guy's, you know, risky by two or one unit, this guy's risky by two units, let me combine those and I'll form a response that's more extreme than either one alone. So that's saying that B or A is adding a little more risk to the environment than B. You know, so probably, you know, this, you know, the response where it's equal makes sense. And this response can make some sense if A is contributing a little more risk than B. But probably not this intermediate response because you're not well defended. Why would you kind of decrease your defense if this other predator is present? Okay, yeah, so it could be costs, right? That say, well, if I respond too much, I'm taking in all these costs, maybe slower growth, longer developmental, all these things.
And okay. How can you get to a phenotypic response that wasn't found at all with just A or B? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, exactly. So how could you get a more extreme response here by just combining two predators? How do you guys think that could happen? Think back to those chemical cues I was talking about. So what could that be doing, right? It could be adding additional Q to the overall, right? So if you have 5 units of Q with B alone, adding A could add 3 more units. So if you're just responding to the total abundance of predators, independent of any identity of the predator, you could get an increase in risk. Good. Any other questions? Did that answer your question? Okay. Data. So what they did here is they had tadpoles reared with 4 different predators, okay? So we have E, which is a dragonfly. This is Erythemis, which is a Libellula dragonfly. It's very low-risk predator. It consumes a few, but it's not very good at doing it. It pretty much sucks at consuming prey. So we consider that very low risk. B is a Bellostoma, so that's a water bug. And we talked about this before. These guys are pretty low risk. Once again, they consume tadpoles by piercing the skin, basically sucking out the digested tissues. But once again, they're a very low-risk predator, too. It takes them very long to consume prey. And then we have Dytiscids, which are the beetle larvae, once again, and Anak, dragonfly larvae, which are tend to be your high-risk predators, okay? They eat faster. They tend to be a little bigger than the other two predators as well. But they also have more efficient ways of capturing the tadpoles. So dragonflies have great, or these larger dragonflies have a much better, basically have a labium that shoots out and grabs a tadpole, and it's very effective at grabbing that tadpole. Dytiscids are the same way. These guys are one of the meanest predators I've ever seen. All they do is just constantly attack. So at some point, they're gonna get the prey, but they just constantly attack until they get the prey in their mouth, or I guess in their pinchers. Okay, so if we have increasing risk here, what's this telling us with basically just these 4 predators? And the 2 here means there were 2 of those predators in cages in those treatments. So if we have activity level and tail depth here, what's that telling us? As risk increases, right. So as risk increases, we get reduced activity. So they're basically detecting that increase in risk. And they're also getting deeper tails. Okay? Make sense? Okay, now what they did is they actually doubled the density of each of these predators. So this kind of gets to your question was, well, you know, why would they respond more? Well, if you have more Q in the water, if you double the density of each one of these predators and increase it to 4, what happens to the phenotype? And what you find is that in only one case do you get a more extreme phenotype with doubling the density. So with four ANACs, you get a much greater reduction in activity than you do with two ANACs. But morphologically, there's no difference here, no difference here, no difference here, no difference here, okay? So that says, basically, if you ignore this point here, if you double the density of predators, it's not making it a more risky situation. So for the most part, it could be that they're already maxed out phenotypically, especially for tail depth. Your tail can only get so deep. You could add all the risk you want, more predators, more predators, more predators, but they're maxed out. They can't go any further. It could be one way to interpret it. The other is that they don't interpret an increase in four predators or an increase to four as a more risky situation. They just don't see it. So they could get a deeper tail, but they just don't do it. Okay, so here's what happens. What they did now was looked at six pairwise combinations of all these different predators. And here's what the data looks like. So basically, you still have kind of increasing risk here. So this treatment here had two ANACs and two Dytisses, which are arguably the most risky of the two predators, or the two predators, sorry. So if you look at something like tail depth, with two ANACs, here's the response you had. Now in general, if you look at the combination here, with two ANACs, two Dytisses, see they're responding basically the same way as they did to two ANACs. Right? So if you look at the error bars, they're kind of telling you whether or not things are different from each other. Right. Activity, same thing. They're not responding in a more extreme way. So how do you guys interpret this? If you look at some of the other combinations, and then I'm going to ask for your interpretation and how they're responding to combined predators in the environment. So another good one is, let's see. Yeah, this one's not too bad. So two Dytisses and Erythmus. So here's Dytissid, here's Erythmus, and there's not much difference there. So what do you guys think? How should you respond to a combined predator? Are you going to produce kind of this intermediate phenotype that we talked about in that one slide where you kind of balance the two risks? How many think that is playing a role? And you're going to balance risk? No? How many think it's going to be more extreme? You think it's going to be more extreme? Okay. Okay. Well, when this researcher kind of averaged it out, what he came up with, you know, in most cases, they're responding to predator combinations, these guys over, depending on, are they responding to the most risky predator in the combination, right, like you're saying. In some cases, it's kind of close, like here, it's getting there, but it's not statistically different than this guy here. So basically what you do is you look at the predator combination as you're a tadpole, and you say, okay, which one's more risky? Which phenotype do I need to produce to get away from that predator? And you produce that phenotype. Questions? Okay. All right, so now let's talk about these alarm cues. So I said I'd get back to this. Now, if you think about you're kind of in this pond, you're kind of floating around in the pond, you're surrounded by water, and there's all these chemical cues kind of floating around with you. You need to process this information to be able to respond to a predator. So I just showed you that tadpoles can process the different cues produced by predators and produce sort of a phenotype that appears to kind of resemble what could, you know, arguably be considered an adaptive phenotype to that level of risk. But now let's talk about the alarm cues versus the caromones. Once again, alarm cues are from these damaged prey. So we can ask the question, are these alarm cues? So if you just damage prey, is that enough to get a response in a tadpole? Right, so you can imagine that you may not want to respond to just damaged prey, because that's not really telling you how that prey was damaged. So you may need that damage to basically occur with some type of predator caromone. So, you know, many predators tend to be generalists, though. So the question becomes, can tadpoles detect when these predators are consuming heterospecific prey?
So just kind of lay this out a little better. If predators are generalists and they're feeding on a wide diet, you may not want to respond to that predator if it's eating something that's, you know, completely unrelated to you, because that may represent low risk to you. That makes sense? Okay, and then if you go back up to alarm cues, you know, if those prey are just damaged, that's really not telling you how to respond. So you don't really, you're not really sure as a tadpole, especially if predators are inducing phenotypes in different directions. If you start going in one direction and the actual predator that's present favors the phenotype in the opposite direction, well, then that could be a maladaptive thing to do. And that's going to get you potentially nailed by that predator. That makes sense? Okay, so what the researcher did was they fed predators a wide range of diets, and they also basically mechanically crushed some of these diets. And they used a blender to do that. So basically, you throw a bunch of snails or a bunch of tadpoles, a bunch of insects in a blender, and then you put a certain amount of that into the water and see if tadpoles respond to it, okay? So here are the responses that they found. So just let me walk you through this real quick. We have three responses: mass, body length, and tail depth. Kind of our standard responses to predators. Mm-hmm. Crushed diets, so things where you just kind of put them in a blender, put it in the water, are in the open symbols. Consumed diets are things where the predator was obviously able to crush it because it ate the predator or ate the prey, as well as it gave off pheromones. That's in the closed symbol. So I also need to explain the x-axis, sorry. So this is basically the diet that was fed to the predator. And the predator in this case was a dragonfly larvae. We have several different anurans, including tree frogs, spring peepers, wood frogs, and leopard frogs, spotted salamanders, dragonflies, and damselflies, two insects, and then two snails, so a physid snail and a statinicola, which is a limnaid snail. Now, the target in this case, the individuals responding are gray tree frog tadpoles. So this diet right here, that's the actual tadpoles that they're looking at to see what they're responding, so what their mass was doing, what their tail depth was doing, okay? So if we look, here's the control. So nothing fed to a predator, nothing crushed. Basically, we see tail depth is very close to each other. And I think I'm reading this wrong. Anyway, why in the control? Oh, okay, that's just water added, sorry. So what they did, if you're gonna add crush, basically just water to the tank. Fresh water. I guess it just went through a blender, they had to add it. Anyway, okay, so what you see is that with tree frogs as the diet, if you feed it to the predator, they respond by increasing tail depth. Now, if you just crush that diet, you get very little response here. If you look at body length, same general trend. They respond to the predator consuming the prey, but they do not respond to a crushed prey. Same thing here with mass. Decrease in mass, no change in response to crushed prey. Okay, the cool thing from this experiment is this general trend. Whereas tail depth tends to respond less as the diet gets more phylogenetically distant from the prey. So here's your, once again, your tree frogs, your other anurans, salamanders. You're still getting a slight response, but as you get into insects and snails, that response is drastically reduced. Same general trend here with body length. So we see a reduction in how strong that response is. And same general thing here with mass. So as the phylogenetic distance increases from the target prey, they respond less and less to that predator consuming the taxa. And there's very little response to just crush cues alone, which we had talked about, kind of makes sense. If you don't know what's actually doing the crushing, it doesn't help you to respond, especially if predators are inducing opposing phenotypes in some way. Any questions on that? Okay, just quickly, we'll talk about some of the costs of these responses. So some people have already mentioned costs, such as slower growth. So basically, why not always just produce this predator-induced phenotype? There can be some costs associated with that response. So what these researchers did, which was Van Buskirk and Relier, so you read papers by both these guys today, frogs were reared with and without cage predators. And then what they did is they took those individuals and they put them into an environment with and without a large bullfrog. And that large bullfrog is essentially a very strong competitor. So if these guys have any traits that are going to make them less competitive, that should show up in their responses to this kind of common growth environment. In general, what they found is that predator-induced tadpoles are actually poor competitors. So what you want to do is basically compare. This is the predator-induced phenotype, this is the no predator phenotype, and this is without bullfrog competitors, this is with bullfrog competitors. And basically what you're looking at is the slope of this line and how it changes for each treatment. So the no predator treatment, when you add bullfrogs as a competitor, this giant tadpole, it's going to consume all your resources. You see they change growth very little. The slope of that line really doesn't change. But for predator-induced tadpoles, the slope of that line changes dramatically. So they pack on less weight in the presence of a bullfrog competitor than they did in the other treatment. Right, so basically they're growing less. They're less competitive tadpoles if you're predator-induced versus non-predator induced. Questions on that? This is a very tough graph to see. I probably shouldn't put it in there, but the reason why you have this is a proportional change in mass over here. The reason why these guys put on more mass overall is because they're actually bigger larvae, bigger tadpoles. So it's not the best comparison to really make because they weren't equal in mass going into this part of the experiment. But that's why I said look at the slope of those lines, and that's really telling you what's going on. But don't worry about that. The cost of this response is typically that you grow slower. Don't worry about the data. I'll tell you what it is. Just believe me. Okay, so you know, given these costs of defense, you know, these guys may want to kind of adjust their phenotype according to the risk posed in the environment. So in many of these systems, predators can colonize as well as leave the habitat at any point in a prey's development. So, you know, like I said, given these costs associated with the defense, slower growth, for example, tadpoles may want to basically track these changes in predation risk. So if a predator leaves, you may want to change your phenotype to say, okay, I'm going to change to a no-predator phenotype so I can be more competitive, so I don't have to pay the cost of expressing this predator-induced phenotype all the time. However, you may not be infinitely plastic. So to be able to respond to that variation, you have to first sense that the predator is left, as well as change your phenotype developmentally. If you have a deeper tail, how are you going to change your tail depth to basically reduce those costs? Okay, so what they did is they took great tree frogs, they put them in wading pools, and they exposed them to different predator environments over time. And they did that by basically adding predator cages or taking predator cages away. So a pretty simple experiment. And they measured tadpoles each time they did this. It was once again with anacs and great tree frog tadpoles. If you look at relative tail depth, so here are the constant environments. So if you're exposed to a caged anax throughout development, you have a deeper tail throughout development compared to the no predator treatment. Activity, though, initially you respond to predators by decreasing activity, but over time that response decreases. So if we just focus on that result, why would activity basically increase over time in these caged predator environments? Why wouldn't you just always respond to predators by decreasing activity? Tadpoles. Okay, so they're habituating to it. But if they're habituating to it, why do you see it maintenance of a deeper tail? And also, the predators are constantly fed. The predators are in a cage, and prey are dropped in every week. Or every 3 days, actually.
Is it other
Sorry, what's that?
Was tadpoles dropped in from the
Yes, tadpoles dropped in from outside the experiment. Basically, had like a little culture pool of tadpoles, and they'll take those out and then drop them in the cages. So think about the cost. So what we just talked about, the cost of plasticity was slower growth, less competitive. Why would you increase activity over time? And think about this. Morphologically, you're very well defended. You got a deeper tail already. So what they do is they say, well, if I'm well defended morphologically, I have less of a risk of getting eaten, so I can increase my activity. So what they're trying to do is actually reduce the cost of expressing plasticity. So if you constantly remain inactive, you're not going to put on any weight. You're not feeding. So what they do is they basically form their defense. They use both defenses early on. They rapidly form morphology. They take down their activity. But over time, they say, you know, I'm still well defended, so I'm going to kind of reduce some of those costs by increasing my activity level. Okay? Okay, so here's what happens where predators colonize. So basically, if you look at tail depth, each time a predator colonizes, these guys form deeper tails. Right? So anytime you add it during development, these guys can respond by forming deeper tails. But interestingly, if you look at behavior, we see very little reduction in behavior each time a predator is added, which may potentially be explained by how rapidly they can form a defense against a predator. So within 1 week, these guys are basically forming a defense, and by 2 weeks, they're no different than that constant predator environment here. So it may not be necessary to dramatically reduce your activity if you can rapidly form a morphological defense. In contrast, if you look at predators basically leaving the habitat or metamorphosing, you see they reverse early on in development, go back down to the no predator phenotype, but late in development, they're constrained. They're stuck on that predator-induced phenotype. You know, potentially, if you had given them another week, they would have reversed that phenotype, but the experiment was only ran for a certain amount of time, so it looks like at least, you know, how quickly they can get down there is constrained. But in general, if you take them away, the predators away early in development, they do become more active the following week. But later in development, overall there's not much change later in development in response to predators, but overall early in development they do seem to reverse their behavioral phenotype. It's a little hard to know what's going on here later in development, but does that make sense? So clearly we've talked about predator-induced plasticity, but it has these costs of reduced growth. We need to think about, well, what effect do competitors have on tadpole responses? And generally, when the abundance of predators is very low, we really have competition being the dominant force. So it's not really this no predator-predator contrast. It tends to be high competition, predation contrast. So here's just some data. If we look at things like body depth and body length, as you add competitors to the environment, you tend to get an increase in body length as well as body depth. You also tend to get higher activity levels, as you guys probably saw in some of the papers, as well as smaller tails. They also form, you imagine, if you're getting a bigger body, what you can produce in that body, and generally what you find is relatively longer guts. So here's competitor density once again and relative gut length. So if you have both intra-specific or interspecific competition, these guys tend to get relatively longer guts. Now, why would you want longer guts? What does that help you do?
Absorb more nutrients.
Right, so you can take in more nutrients. It basically also increases retention time. So it has to go through a much longer tube. So that allows you to absorb more nutrients from that food. And it's thought that this contrast between predator-induced environment or predator-induced plasticity and competitor-induced plasticity will actually favor plasticity because you have these two contrasting environments that basically favor two phenotypes or two different phenotypes in the environment. So that's really setting up this idea of phenotypic trade-offs for the organism and why do you want to respond to that environmental variation. What cues are actually going to be used to detect competition? So we talked about predator cues. What can you use if you're going to sense a competitor environment? Intake? Okay. Okay. So it could be overall reduced food resources, or even per capita food resources. Any of those things tend to drop, you could get an increase in basically a signal of competition. What else could you be sensing?
Waste.
Yeah, so a buildup of maybe nitrogen or ammonia in the environment. You could be sensing that increase, and you could be using that to change your phenotype. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it could be number of individuals in the environment. So you could basically see other tadpoles and respond to that. Great ideas. So not really going to talk about the cues too much right now. There are some papers out there. So Rick Relia's research, I think, has a 2000 paper. Talks about some of the cues for competition and basically talking about competitor-induced plasticity. So if you're interested in picking up on which cues are most important, it turns out that for the most part it's per capita food resources that we're responding to. So if you decrease in basically per capita food, you respond. You do not tend to get too much of a response to just a change in density. So you can increase density, 20 individuals in a tub, but as long as they have all the food they need, they don't respond in a kind of competitive way. So it's really that drop in per capita food resources that they're using. Okay, so what I want to talk about here is basically, well, how are you going to balance this risk of, if you have predators present and you have competitors present, how do you fine-tune your phenotype to deal with both these environments? So you can do a simple experiment which just manipulate the number of caged predators in the environment as well as the density of competitors. So you can see that here. Predator density is on the x-axis, so it's either 1 up to 4 predators in the environment. Competitor density is going to be the different lines, so either 20 individuals, 40, 80, or 160. So what do we see here? If we look at something like activity, how do you interpret activity here? What are they doing in response to, say, predators? Okay, yeah, so they're lowering activity as the number of predators increases. How does competition influence that response? Right, exactly. So basically, as the competitor density increases, the degree to which you respond to predators decreases, right? So basically these lines are moving up this way. So at this high competition, you respond to predators very little. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you need to find more food resources, there's higher competition, there's more individuals around you. So you're increasing your activity to feed more. So if you respond very strongly to the predators, we're not going to get any food, exactly. Okay. What do we see here with tail depth? How are they responding to predators? Right, so there's not much, well. Right. So they're responding to predators by forming deeper tails, right? But generally, if we look at responses to competitors, there's not much of a change here from 20 to 80 individuals in the tank.
But it's when you get all the way up to 160 is when you see a decrease in tail depth. But overall, it's interesting that they're still responding pretty strongly to predators.
The way it levels out, is it kind of like they run out of the resources to continue the tail length increasing? And could that be part of it?
Yeah, definitely. So if you look at, do I have math? Growth, yeah. So here's growth. If you look at growth overall, high competition, across predator treatments, growth is very low, right? So basically, you know, per individual, these guys have very few resources because there's just so many of them in these tanks. So yeah, growth is drastically reduced. And then, I guess if we stick with growth, predators do tend to decrease growth. And so if you look here in the tank, presence of one predator brings it down by about, what was that, maybe 4 milligrams per day. With further reduction at the presence of two predators, but no change from 2 to 4. But basically, as she was saying, as you increase the density of competitors, basically the cost you're paying is increased. So there's a lot less food to go around. So it appears as though what they're doing is balancing the risk of predation and the competitor density in the environment. But like I said, you know, rarely do you have high predator densities and high competitor densities. You know, you don't really have this combination right here, where you have 4 predators and tons of individuals around, because those predators will be eating all those extra individuals. Yeah. The leopard frog?
Yeah, the leopard frog and the wood frog.
Let's hold off. What time is it? Let me see how much more I got. Just 2 more slides? Okay. Yeah, so we'll talk about that all in about probably 10 minutes. Oh, sweet. We'll talk about that now. Okay, so you know, here's what we're going to talk about today, and then here are some cool books. If you guys find any interest in this topic and you want to kind of explore a little more, some really good books. This one by Massimo Pigliucci in 2003 is pretty good. He wrote it for a very general audience, so you can basically pick that up and get the basics. But it also gives you some really cool examples of plasticity and a lot of other taxa. This is if you want a really in-depth book. This came out in 2003, too. She'll basically overwhelm you with all of her knowledge. It's insane. I've only gotten like halfway through it and my head hurts. But this was the first book that was really put out on, it wasn't specifically phenotypic plasticity, it's more about kind of how phenotypes evolve. And obviously the environmental influence on a phenotype can really be really important. So that's basically a component of this book, but it's a really strong component. So kind of general knowledge, in-depth knowledge, intermediate knowledge. And this is an edited volume that talks about a lot of different examples of plasticity. And I have all these books if you ever want to see them. So, and that'll be it. And let's take about a 5-minute break, and then we'll talk about some of these papers.